Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 22nd of June, these are our main stories. A leading US Democrat has said President Trump was wrong to reveal his last-minute change of mind about a planned attack on Iran, saying it undermined the notion of a clear American plan. Protesters in the Georgian capital, Tbilisi, have demanded the resignation of the Interior Minister, blaming him for violence against demonstrators on Thursday night. Spain's highest court has increased the prison sentences of five men who raped a woman at a bull running festival, sparking mass protests about Spanish rape laws. Also in this podcast,
400,000, 420, 450, 480, 500, $1 million.
A Pink Floyd guitar collection raises more than $20 million at auction. The beneficiary, the world's climate. A leading US Democrat has criticised Donald Trump for revealing his last-minute change of mind about a planned attack on Iran following its downing of a surveillance drone. Adam Smith, the chair of the House Armed Services Committee, warned it was not smart of the president to make the details public, saying it undermined the notion of a clear American plan. They discussed the decision on Thursday. Our correspondent in Washington, Barbara Plett-Archer, says Mr. Trump appears to be conflicted about how to handle the situation.
We do know that he has vacillated between sounding tough on Iran, but also indicating that he's reluctant to go to war. And actually, earlier in that day, he downplayed the event itself. So he has been a little bit all over the map. But in the end, what he decided to do was strengthen sanctions instead. He said more sanctions had put in place. And certainly his aides have been telling him that they are being effective.
Barbara Plett-Archer. The BBC's Kevin Connolly has been getting Iran's reaction to Thursday's events. He asked Syed Sajjadpour, one of Iran's deputy foreign ministers, how serious the tensions in the Gulf were at the moment.
The tensions are there, but it's very difficult to gauge. But of course, the region has been having a record of such intense interactions in the past.
But we are told, for example, that overnight, the United States had warplanes in the air on their way to attack Iranian targets, and that the government of Iran was warned that those planes were on the way through an intermediary, and that quite suddenly that attack was called off. So a lot is happening in the skies over and near your country.
I read also the reports, but I don't have the details.
I've seen Iran say, the Iranian government say, we are ready for war. What does that mean? Because that sounds like a frightening statement to a lot of people around the world.
No, you have to be careful in reading what we say. First of all, Iran has said repeatedly that we are not for the start of the war. But if we are attacked, we defend our country. I think it is a very natural response of any human being, but we don't initiate war. And this is very important to keep in mind, that when it comes to the defense of the land, Iran is Iran and all Iranians are united. This is what we mean, that we are ready to defend our country when we see these pronouncements. Iran is the only country in that region which is 100% produces its own security.
It goes a little bit beyond the sort of philosophy of independence and defense, doesn't it? If there were American warplanes in the air last night, you're saying if they had carried out an attack on Iranian targets, then Iran would respond. I mean, that is a war.
If they inter-Iranian space, as it did. So when you violate Iranian territorial space, then we defend.
Donald Trump said last month to the government of Iran, call me. Why don't you call him?
For a very simple reason. It is not an ordinary call. Can you put a knife on my throat and tell me, come and negotiate? Is it a normal setting for negotiation? Don't forget that what the United States is doing, that is the economic sanctions on Iran, is equal to war on people. We call it economic terrorism. Why the ordinary Iranians should be suffering? For what reason? It is a simple call for submission. and it is not a regular, natural call. If you call him, you mean you are submitting to his, let's say, wishes. I think it is a very ironic theatrical scene.
Sayed Sajjadpour, one of Iran's deputy foreign ministers. Well, the United States has banned all US-registered aircraft from flying in Iranian-controlled airspace over the Gulf and neighbouring waters. The US Federal Aviation Administration warned of the risk of misidentification of planes in the region. The drone shot down by an Iranian missile was the size of a passenger aircraft. Airlines from other countries, including British Airways, the Dutch carrier KLM and Qantas of Australia, have also said they'll reroute their flights to avoid the area. John Strickland is an aviation analyst from JLS Consultancy.
The impact of the news we've heard in the last 24 hours will vary by airline, depending on how much exposure they have to flying to or over this part of the world. Now, American carriers in particular fall under the safety jurisdiction of the FAA. So the FAA, if they put a ban in place, those airlines are duty-bound to observe that ban. They would simply get their licenses rescinded if not. Other airlines, for example, the carriers based in the Gulf, such as Emirates in Dubai, Qatar Airways in Doha, or Etihad in Abu Dhabi, of course, are very much more exposed to changes in airspace access because it is their home territory. And then other airlines, for example, European carriers who are overflying the Gulf on their way to places like India and Asia, have a lesser but an important impact. Of course, we've seen recent airspace closures from the political tensions between India and Pakistan. Some of those are still in place, and that's meant airlines have been flying longer flights. Any longer flight, of course, directly adds to costs from an airline point of view. From a customer point of view, it means you're not going to be on time. You'll at least have a delay. But of course, it is about keeping the show on the road as far as possible, always with the caveat that safety comes first and airlines will do whatever is necessary to protect their safety.
John Strickland, an aviation analyst from JLS Consultancy. And now on to other news. In the capital of Georgia, Tbilisi, for a second evening running, anti-government protesters gathered outside Parliament. They called for the resignation of the Interior Minister. On Thursday evening, more than 240 people were injured when riot police used tear gas, rubber bullets and water cannon to stop protesters storming the building. They were angry that a Russian MP had been allowed to give a speech in Russian in the chamber. The Georgian president, Salome Zurabishvili, told the BBC she blamed the Russians for stirring up trouble in her country.
At this time, when Georgia is really the country that moves steadily toward the West, steadily towards Europe, that is holding a very important partnership European Union conference next month, that is when suddenly there are calls for destabilization. So that is something that we should be looking at in geopolitical terms. And it's clear that Russia is trying to undermine the one country that knows where it goes and has a clear European and NATO perspective.
I've been speaking to our correspondent, Rehan Dimitri, who's been out on the streets with protesters in Tbilisi.
I see so many people outside the Georgian parliament. I would say probably even twice as many as yesterday. The street, the central artery that runs through Tbilisi, the Georgian capital, is absolutely packed by protesters. The speaker is gone, but it feels like it wasn't enough, and they're saying it's only the beginning. They are now demanding the resignation of the country's interior minister. But also, you know, this protest that is happening, I'm hearing a lot of emotional kind of heated speeches that are being made outside parliament, and a lot of speeches are about people's frustrations about their relations with Russia, anti-Russian rhetoric, very, very strong anti-Russian rhetoric. And that's in reference to Georgia's two breakaway regions that are controlled by Russia. So the word that I can see, the sentence that I can see written everywhere in the placards that people are holding right now, a girl somehow managed to enter this protest area in a motorcycle, and on her helmet it's written, Russia is an occupier. So that kind of reflects this general mood that that is present here at this moment.
So briefly, Rehan, people there are saying that the present government in that country is now not being tough enough on Russia.
Absolutely. So what happened on Thursday with this Russian lawmaker really was a catalyst for so many kind of frustrations and grievances that people have about the way their country, their government has been handling a relationship with Russia. But I must say, the current Georgian administration is pro-European. They never said that they're pro-Russian, but what people, I guess, they're frustrated about is, again, this lost territories. They want the lost territories back, and they want the government to be much tougher in its dealing with Russia when it comes to those lost breakaway regions.
Rehan Dimitri in Georgia. Now to Spain, where in a landmark case, the Supreme Court has found five men who call themselves the Wolf Pack guilty of rape. They'd twice previously been convicted for the lesser offence of sexual abuse. The men raped the 18-year-old woman in Pamplona in 2016 at the start of the popular bull running festival in the entrance to an apartment building. They filmed the incident and shared footage on social media. I asked our correspondent Guy Hedgecote why this case was so controversial.
A lot of the controversy stems from the court's original verdict, the fact that it issued that verdict of sexual abuse instead of rape in the first place. Now, although the defendants received sentences of 9 years, that was 9 years not for rape, for sexual abuse. Many people felt that this was very clearly a case of rape, that from what was in the public domain, it seemed clear to many people that the evidence was there for them to be convicted of rape. And I think that also fed into a broader issue of women's rights and equality and sexual violence in Spain that was already an important issue. But also there were other details surrounding the case. For example, this sexual encounter, some of it was recorded on one of the defendant's mobile phone. They bragged about it on WhatsApp with friends of theirs before they were arrested. And there was a huge amount of public interest in this because so much was there in the public domain. The media had access to a lot of information about this case. And that's really why it caught people's attention and why it became so controversial.
Now, the judge in this latest case gave the ruling under the existing law, which, as you said, requires intimidation or violence to be proved for it to be considered rape. What, though, do you think is the wider significance of this case? Is there a possibility of a change in the law?
Well, yeah, certainly that was really such a key point in this case throughout, in the initial court case and then again with the Supreme Court appeal, whether there was violence or intimidation. And you know, clearly the Supreme Court has decided that there is in this case. But there is a feeling that the law has been too open to interpretation, and that was a big problem here. And even before this final verdict, politicians in the political mainstream have been talking about the need to reform the law on this issue. And speaking to reporters outside the courthouse, the president of the Association of Women Jurists, Maria Ángeles Jaime de Pablo, called on the government to change the law in cases like this one.
I think the Wolfpack case has to lead us to consider a legislative change, and I hope Parliament takes this legal reform seriously, which society is demanding, and it seems there is a consensus for.
Certainly what she was saying there about the need for a consensus in society about this issue of sexual assault cases, that has come very much into the political mainstream. And the main political parties have been talking about this. Political parties are very divided on a lot of issues, but it seems that on the issue of sexual assault and rape cases, it's one of the few issues that perhaps they might be able to form a consensus on.
Guy Hedgecote in Spain. Now, how long can you last without the internet? People in Sudan have been offline since the 3rd of June when the ruling military council switched off connectivity in response to mass protests. The BBC's Tommy Oladipo in Khartoum has been observing the impact of the shutdown on the demonstrations and on life in general.
This is a group of a few dozen young men and boys holding placards and waving flags of Sudan as they walk through the dusty streets and alleys of this neighbourhood. Other residents are coming up, some joining them, others standing in front of their houses and joining the chanting, mostly women and young children.
We think it's almost like we're back to square one. It took 4 months to topple former President Bashir, but now we have planned a number of peaceful moves to remove the military council. These neighborhood protests are just the start.
At a wealthier neighborhood, yet another gathering. This one smaller, less intense, and in a garden hidden by high walls.
See, as you see, last message was received June the 3rd.
One young woman tells me how hard it's been to assemble since Sudan's internet was switched off nearly 3 weeks ago. We're not naming her for her own safety.
We are willing to do a change, and actually, to be honest, at the moment, we don't know how to do it. It will be very dangerous to arrange for a meeting between different districts.
How do you spark the conversation then?
Right now with calls and SMS, because I have to update my friends in other neighborhoods what's going on mine. It's highly expensive. It's not very efficient. We are worried if it's someone is listening, someone is seeing it, but we don't have other way.
This is what the internet shutdown was meant to achieve, to keep the opposition groups from mobilizing in large numbers and becoming the kind of vocal force they were on the streets a few weeks ago. But the impact of this lack of connectivity goes beyond the protests. There are people whose incomes have suffered too.
To travel around Khartoum, I would like to try a popular local taxi app called Terhal. But of course, it can't work while the internet's off, so I have to flag down a cab.
This taxi driver is Al Rashid, and he's a regular user of the Terhal app.
I sold my previous business to buy this car. But since the internet's been down, I'm not even making 20% of what I used to. It's difficult to meet any of my family's basic needs.
In fact, the total economic loss that Sudan is suffering from being offline is estimated to be in the hundreds of millions of dollars. The military regime seems willing to make that sacrifice if it can keep a lid on the uprising. The move might have disrupted the protesters' means of rallying, but it has not killed their hope.
That report by Tommy Oladipo in Sudan. And now, news of another podcast from the BBC World Service.
An unidentified body in a remote Norwegian valley.
She was laying with her head down there.
Who was she? Fake passports, the wigs, the unprescripted glasses.
And what was she doing there?
She has an agenda and she doesn't want to talk about it.
I'm Marit Hegraff.
And I'm Neil McCarthy. And in Death in Ice Valley, we tried to find answers to a mystery that has remained unsolved for 48 years.
There are somebody living who knows more about this case.
Tracking down eyewitnesses and using new forensic technology.
Now I'm cutting the tooth.
Telling a story set deep in the Cold War with strong hints of espionage.
If you take the missile, I will shoot.
But it left us with a lingering feeling that someone didn't want the truth to be known.
Obviously, he was told by some people to keep his mouth shut.
We're about to come back with an update, so now's the perfect time to catch up with the whole series.
Why all this secrecy?
It was like a cover-up.
What on earth happened that day?
That's Death in Ice Valley from the BBC World Service and NRK.
I think we'll break this case right now.
Just search for Death in Ice Valley wherever you get your podcasts.
And now back to the Global News podcast. The parents of a British man who went to Syria to join the Islamic State group have been found guilty of funding terrorism by sending him money. John Letts and Sally Lane sent payments to their son, nicknamed Jihadi Jack, in 2015, despite police warnings that they would be prosecuted if they did so. A court in London, known locally as the Old Bailey, gave them 15 months suspended sentences on one charge of transferring about $300. Our correspondent Chichi Uzundu was in court.
This was the sound that greeted Sally Lane and John Letts as they left the Old Bailey. Their argument throughout the court case was that as loving parents, they had no choice but to help their son, Jack Letts. Their solicitor, Tayyab Ali, spoke on their behalf outside court.
We believed that our son's life was in imminent danger. We tried to do the right thing. We fully cooperated with the police and asked them repeatedly for help. They promised they would help us. But instead of helping us, they used the information we provided to prosecute us. The heavy price we paid today is an indicator of the love that we have for our children.
Jack Letts became interested in Islam after doing a school project on it when he was 15. At 16, he converted. 2 years later, he travelled to Jordan, telling his parents he was going to study Arabic. The court had heard that friends from his mosque in Oxford had warned Sani Lane and John Letts about the extremist videos their son had been watching online and the company he'd been keeping in the UK. Sani Lane told the jury at the Old Bailey that she was horrified when he'd called her in September 2014 to say he was in Syria. She said she'd screamed at him, "How could you be so stupid?" After a year, Jack Letts began asking for money. At first to help a poor friend who had lots of children, then it was to get him out of Syria. The pair argued that they did not believe their son was actively fighting in the Middle East. And in a police interview, John Letts had said he didn't know what choice he had but to help his son.
"I've got to get him out somehow. And how am I going to do that? He's in danger and I feel I have to do something. But on the other hand, I don't want to get put away and I don't want Sally to get put away. You know, I've got another son to worry about. So what am I supposed to do? And I still don't know what to do."
Despite warnings from police, Ms. Lane was captured on CCTV at her local Western Union in Oxford, sending £223. In sentencing, Judge Nicholas Hilliard said he understood they were parents who loved their son very much, but the warning signs were there. He sentenced them each to 15 months in jail, suspended for a year, and ordered them to pay £140 in fines.
Chichi Uzundu there. Jack Letts, who's now 23, has spent the last 2.5 years in a Kurdish jail in northern Syria. He spoke to the BBC last October in an interview that can now be broadcast for the first time. Jack Letts said he wasn't speaking under duress and wanted to come clean about his membership of the IS group. Our Middle East correspondent Quentin Somerville met him at the Syrian prison where he's being held.
Jack Letts was a wholehearted IS member, fighting for the group and becoming badly injured on the front line in Fallujah, Iraq. I spoke to him in October last year. The interview can only be broadcast now that his parents' trial has ended. I asked him if he'd betrayed his country.
What were you? Were you a traitor or were you a collaborator? So that's the question I'm asking you.
A traitor to Britain, Yanni. You mean a traitor to Britain? It's the first time I heard that term in a long time. I know, I was definitely an enemy of Britain. There's, I have no doubts about this. I haven't tried to make myself innocent. I did what I did. I made a big mistake. And that's what happened, Jenny. I regretted what I did and thought, you know, supposedly the British idea is that even if you do make big mistakes, you can sort of go back. Not go back to Britain, I mean, you can go back from your mistakes. You can set things right.
Did they ever ask you to put on a suicide vest?
They don't ask you, but they encourage you in a sort of indirect way. I used to want to at one point, believe it or not. I now think it's actually haram. It's the first time I actually say this here, but khalas, I might as well tell the truth. I did at one point want to. Not a vest, but I wanted to do it in a car. So I said, if there's a chance, I'll do it. I didn't say it, and I didn't request to do it. But at the same time, it was obvious that I made it obvious to him that if there was a battle, I'm ready.
Unlike other British IS members, he hasn't been stripped of his UK citizenship. He is a dual Canadian national. Britain has left Canada to deal with his case. Jack Letts has spent the last 2.5 years in a Kurdish jail cell in northern Syria. There's no indication that he'll be released from there anytime soon.
That report by Quentin Somerville. The Guardian newspaper in Britain is reporting that police were called to the home of the Conservative leadership candidate Boris Johnson and his partner on Thursday night after a neighbour heard a noisy row. In a statement, the Metropolitan Police said that officers had attended the property but had found no cause for concern. Here's our political correspondent, Jessica Parker.
The Guardian reports that it has spoken to a neighbour of Boris Johnson, who told the paper that they heard slamming and banging, and that at one point Mr Johnson's partner, Carrie Simmons, was allegedly heard by the neighbour saying, "Get out of my flat." The Guardian says that the neighbour tape recorded some of the alleged row, a recording that the BBC has not heard. A spokesman for Boris Johnson said they would not be commenting. In a statement, the Metropolitan Police confirmed that officers responded to a call shortly before 12:30 and found the occupants safe and well, and that there was no cause for concern.
Jessica Parker. Zimbabwe's president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, says he will introduce a new currency by March next year, ending a decade-old policy which allowed foreign currencies, including the US dollar, to be used locally. Mr. Mnangagwa told the Bloomberg news agency that the new currency would help revive the economy. Shingai Nyoka reports from Harare.
Before the Zimbabwe dollar's demise, $3 trillion was equivalent in value to a loaf of bread. Authorities believe the economy is now stable enough to warrant bringing back the Zimbabwe dollar, and they've tried to warm up locals by introducing a surrogate currency. But since February, the real-time gross settlement, or RTGS dollar, has tumbled against the greenback by 60%. Inflation is at a decade high at 100% as a result of market jitters. And some businesses are now even demanding payment in US dollars.
Shingai Nyoka in Zimbabwe. A guitar collection belonging to the Pink Floyd musician David Gilmour has broken pre-auction expectations during a sale in New York. The lots, including a black Fender Stratocaster from 1969, fetched around $21.5 million. Our entertainment correspondent Colin Patterson was watching.
Christie's delayed the start of this auction by an hour as people were still queuing right around the block outside New York's Rockefeller Center. And once bidding began, records were broken.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Black Strat.
The 1969 Black Fender Stratocaster David Gilmour played on Pink Floyd albums including The Wall, Wish You Were Here, and Dark Side of the Moon. The price kept going up.
400,000, 420, 450, 480, 500. $1 million. $1 million two, $1 million three.
Eventually reaching more than 25 times its estimate. £3.1 million.
This is your moment.
Making it the most expensive guitar ever sold at auction. In total, the 126 lots fetched almost £17 million, beating the record for the world's most expensive collection of instruments, previously held by an Eric Clapton auction. The money raised will all be donated to a climate change charity. Kind of appropriate, given that this was some of the most expensive recycling in history.
That report was by Colin Patterson in New York. And that's all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this edition or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.